This is messages that are one or more blocks of n in bits. Yeah. Which is different from this. What's this?
Zero or more.
Yeah, so this could also be the empty string, right? Zero or more. So let's say, just for sake, because if we have this, there's a bit more we need to handle, so let's go ahead and just make this a plus for the moment. Let's assume we have a message that we can break into n-bit chunks, so we can forget about the additive stuff for a little while. Well, so let's take the chunks, and let's call them, you know, m1, m2, and so on. And let's say in particular that this has L blocks. So the message itself is of length n times L bits. So then this is ciphertext block 1, ciphertext block 2, and so on. That's a perfectly reasonable first stab at how to handle messages that are longer than n bits. We're still restricted, because we can only handle messages that are exact multiples of n long, but we can at least handle those. We really ultimately like to be able to handle effectively strings of any length. So 0, 1, star. But we'll start here. This, in fact, is a real encryption scheme. This is something called electronic codebook mode. Or ECB. This name comes from the fact that, you know, back in the good old days, or bad old days, maybe, of cryptography, before there was any, like, serious study of it academically, you would, you know, if you had a string that you wanted to encrypt, you would literally look up in a code book what a string mapped to and write down the string that it maps to. And oftentimes these code books were rotated daily so that you wouldn't have, you know, somebody stole a code book, they'd only know how to do things in the past or for that particular day, right? So electronic code book is essentially saying you're doing the same thing. You can think about this as a table that tells you what to substitute. If I have this n-bit string, then the key names the table, names the code book, and tells you what string to output. Yeah. That's why it's called electronic code book mode, ECB. This is a real encryption scheme. So the first thing I want to do, I told you that any time that we start talking about a new cryptographic primitive, which we are now, we're talking about encryption schemes, we're no longer talking about block ciphers. The first thing we do is we establish what is the syntax. What is the, you know, what are the inputs and outputs for this thing? So what is the syntax that this scheme suggests? Well, it's pretty common to use a sort of calligraphic E to denote encryption. So we have an encryption scheme that, what does it take in? Yeah, we know it takes in a string from this set. Takes in something else, so I'm going to write like this, 0, 1, the n, plus. What is it output?
C, 0, the
same thing. Same set, yeah. Takes in something else.
Key.
Yeah, it takes in a key, right? So we better name some set from which these keys are drawn. If this is a block cipher, then that key set will be whatever is the key set for the underlying block cipher. But in general, we usually just name some set K, calligraphic K, to be the key set. So let me start labeling things. This is the key space, it's typically called. This is the plain text space. This is the ciphertext space.
Is there the time where the plaintext space is not the ciphertext space?
Yes, absolutely. We'll see examples like in 5 minutes.
And also with the key space, how come we don't use like the bits and the brackets?
So you can, but to be more general, we typically allow the key space to be Well, okay, so we know if you want to encrypt something, you go forwards, right? And then you want to deliver this ultimately to a sender, and they're going to want to recover what was there. So we have to define decryption as well. So the decryption, how do you decrypt here? By handing the ciphertext, how do you decrypt?
Break it into
blocks.
I mean,
it's obvious, right? Yeah. Just go backwards through each of these things, and because this thing is a permutation, you know you get exactly what was sent. So this also suggests then a decryption algorithm, which is typically written in this sort of strict DD. Well, for sure, you're going to need the same key if you're going to decrypt properly, so the key set is the same, or the key space is the same. It takes in strings from the ciphertext space, so really the signature syntax is exactly the same. Ciphertexts are coming from blah, we'll say the set for the plaintext are coming from blah. You know what I'm talking about is the actual syntax for the object that sets these things. Good. Okay, so we know how to do encryption. We could write down in pseudocode a very simple algorithm for this. You know, on input, a message. We typically, well, let me say one thing before I move on. We have some notation for these things. Just like we did for block ciphers, we don't typically write this, you know, E, K, M. We don't typically write this. Instead, what we do is we write this in this sort of function family notation. And we do this largely because there is a big semantic difference between this thing and this thing. This thing is something that you provide, and this thing is, well, you provide, and it doesn't have to be a secret necessarily. This, however, this is, you know, this is the secret key. If this thing gets lost, then we're done. So we typically write this thing downstairs as we did for block ciphers. So we write this, E sub K of M, to denote the encryption under key K message. And we use this left arrow notation, which I think I introduced in one of the videos, this assigned, yeah? This thing outputs some value, which we'll call C. And you read that as the encryption of M under key K produces the ciphertext C. Cool. Well, all right. Let's think about this thing. What are the upsides to ECB mode? Simple. Very simple. As I said, you can write down the algorithm. It's dirt simple, right? It's a for loop, essentially. You take in message, parse it into chunks of n bits, then you do a for loop, which goes over the number of blocks that you get after parsing, and inside that for loop, you simply run the block cipher, and then you start appending ciphertext blocks, and then output the resulting string. Very simple. What else?
Parallel.
Sorry?
Parallel.
It's parallel. No? Both, in both directions. Parallel for encryption and for decryption. So if you have an operational environment in which you actually can take advantage of parallelism, that's good, super fast. What are some potential downsides to this?
If you crack one, you can crack every one of those to the seconds.
I mean, if you recover the key?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That's going to be true in any case. Every encryption scheme that we ever build, if you can recover the key, then all hope is lost.
Remember in the video that you posted, there was like some of the encryption schemes where the thing would feed into the next one.
Right, we're going to see that.
Because it doesn't have that, I would assume it's a little easier to break. Because you can isolate one.
Yeah, break in what sense? We haven't actually established any sort of security notion for it.
Recover
the key, for sure. You can recover the key. But recovering the key from this thing ought not to be any easier than recovering the key from the inline block ever by itself. And in fact, that would be an easy reduction to show. If we defined key recovery for an encryption scheme as a security notion, easy to do, you could show that key recovery security for the underlying block cipher implies key recovery security for the encryption scheme. That would be a very easy reduction to do. Now, there's more here. This is a really, really bad encryption scheme. You should never, ever use it.
Yeah, if you see a bunch of plain text ciphers with text pairs for the same key.
That's true, but that'll also be true for every encryption scheme that we build.
Okay.
No. Yeah.
In same plain text, I'm trying to look at the same ciphertext.
Excellent, yeah. If I have all zeros and all zeros, these two ciphertext blocks are the same. Now this might seem like, who cares? Do you remember in the video, I think it was like the second part of the first or second lecture, where I had this webpage up from Kingston?
You want to see the CBC?
What's that?
The cyber block chaining?
Well, the first thing they showed was ECB load, actually.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and I don't know if you remember, but next to this picture of ECB mode were two pictures.
Yeah.
One was of the Linux Penguin, and the other one was the ECB encryption of the Linux Penguin. And what did you notice about those?
It still looked like a penguin.
You could still see the penguin. Yeah. In fact, this is a phrase that I adopted some number of years ago, and we want to describe an encryption scheme as best. Like, you can still see the penguin. Yeah. You can still see the penguin. And that is a direct consequence of the fact that if you put in the same block of message in multiple places, you'll see the same ciphertext out. The way this translates in that image is each of these blocks is going to be a block of pixels. Yeah? And so even though the pixel value changes to something random, it changes in the same way for that pixel value, no matter where it is. And so as a result, edges, if you were to look at, as a computer, just looking at the bits, you see patterns. But what's really damaging is when you look at it as a human, you can clearly see, yeah, the colors have changed, but the penguin is clearly visible. So in fact, you haven't really hidden the plain text. You've scrambled it, for sure, but you haven't hidden it. Because a human being can look at that and say, yeah, the plain text is penguin, right? So this is bad. Another sort of classic example that's given of why this is bad is imagine the following scenario. You have a country that has been ruled by a dictator for many years, and because of international pressures, he finally succumbs to having elections in the country. And he says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take, you guys are going to vote. Everybody in the country can vote. It's a free and open election. We're going to encrypt all of your votes using ECB mode. I'll be the dictator. I'm not going to know the key. The key will be held by the United Nations. Only they'll be able to decrypt. They'll tally the votes, and whatever they tell us, whoever they tell us is the winner. This will be the next president. Well, so let's just imagine. It's easy for all the votes to fit into one 128-bit block. There aren't two of the 128 candidates, right? So we have a ballot. The ballot has, my name first, and then two or three more other candidates running for office. Everybody gets a vote, including me. So these votes are now all collected up, and let's say I see all the ciphertext. What can I determine based on that?
Who voted for you?
Who voted for me? Yeah? Who voted for me? So of course, now I can go out and, exact whatever retribution I want for the people who didn't vote for me. That's, again, a consequence of the fact that this thing is a deterministic map. Yeah? Anytime the same message gets encrypted, the same ciphertext comes out. And so any kind of a priori knowledge I have about the message, the plain text, I can leverage that. So this is already starting to point to something we're going to want about encryption schemes, and that is, it ought to be the case that if I encrypt the same message twice, I don't see the same ciphertext. Now, we don't want deterministic mappings. We don't want to be able to see repetitions of plain text. So this is going to meet that, for sure. So let's try something else. The something else is, here's your idea.
We probably wouldn't want to change the key every time, right?
Well, you could do that, right? You could do that. In fact, that would fix the problem.
But
yeah. If you you change the key, if I change the key with every vote, yeah, or if I'm encrypting the Linux Penguin, in fact, it's not even, yeah, if I'm encrypting the Penguin, what do I actually have to do? How do I avoid being able to see the Penguin by key changes?
Increment the key every pixel.
Yeah, I have to change the key with each block. And that's bad. You don't want to have to do that. Even if you say I'm going to do something as simple as incrementing the key, I still have to rekey every time I go. And rekeying block ciphers typically accounts for a significant fraction of the runtime. I don't know that it's still the case, but in some of the early implementations of AES, setting up the key cost about 50% of the runtime. So you don't want to have to change the key every time you call the block cipher. Yeah.
Is that because of key scheduling?
It's because of key scheduling, and particular, it's because the fastest implementations of AES, at least early on, relied on building lookup tables, and building those lookup tables had to be redone every time you changed the key.
Okay.
So while once the key was in place, if you're doing lots of blocks, that's okay. You can now amortize the cost of doing this key work. But if you're doing small blocks, then that cost becomes expensive. There's less to amortize it over. And certainly, if you're changing the key every block, you don't want to do that.
Okay.
So changing the key, bad idea, at least on every block. Well, so what we observed was with ECB mode, you get this sort of repetition. The same message block twice, you see the same value twice. One way to break this is, well, here's my intuition. If I put in a block here, and it's something new, say, it's the all zeros have never been seen before, this is a random output string. Yeah? So if I want to then like scramble, if I want to somehow make sure that even if this is the same, this is all zeros as well, I can sort of protect myself against that by using random bits that are here to scramble this effectively. And that's one way to do this. It's like this. Yeah? So if this is random, then even if this is all zeros and this is all zeros, the value I see here will almost certainly be different than the value I see here, because if I XOR all zeros with random, well, if this is all zeros, what I'm actually enciphering is this, which is random, which is almost certainly not the all zeros block. So this thing is a new random string, and so on. So you just keep repeating this.
I think it's useful to draw one more block. So maybe this is L minus one. I need to do one more. And this is the last block.
Good. I heard somebody mumble cipherblock chaining.
Cipherblock chaining mode.
These are all called modes. They're modes, I'm not even sure where this name came. These are called modes of operation of a block cipher. So there's PCB mode, CBC mode, counter mode, they're all called modes. So this is CBC. CBC mode. Almost. It's actually not quite. Cool, so, well, this looks like maybe it'll take care of the problem we just solved. The syntax of this thing is the same, as drawn at least, yeah. We still take in messages that have to be multiples of n bits long. We still output some ciphertext that are multiples of n bits long. And the underlying key set is still the underlying key, the key set is the underlying key set of block cipher. Good, so the syntax hasn't changed any. Question is, does this actually fix the problem?
Not quite as it's written.
Why?
How do you get this thing started?
What's that?
So at the beginning, like if you start out with the same message and the same key, you'll always get the same block at the beginning.
You still leak repetitions. Yeah. So certainly, if you start with the same first message block, then the ciphertext block will be repeated. start with the same first two message blocks, what happens?
So
the first two message ciphertext blocks are repeated. If I encrypt the same message twice, what happens? You see the same ciphertext. So we still have a deterministic mapping from plaintext to ciphertext. So we're still leaking repetitions of plaintext, which, as we said, is something we don't want to do. There are lots and lots of applications in which leaking repetitions of plaintext, or even repetitions of plaintext blocks, is damaging. You know, I think the one that people use most dramatically is like, what if your messages are simply launch, don't launch? Yeah, you're just sending these messages along, don't launch, don't launch, don't launch, don't launch. You know exactly, you know, you have some a priori knowledge about what the plaintext space is, and you know that with overwhelming probability, the plaintext are going to be don't launch. So when you see the ciphertext, you can pretty much assume it's a ciphertext for don't launch. And of course you see it repeated over time, so that just, you know, further map. And then as soon as you see a change, well, you know you should get ready. What we're actually doing there is leveraging this classical cryptanalytic technique called frequency analysis. You guys know what frequency analysis is? Yeah, if you have some proper information about the distribution of the messages that are being sent. This, by the way, is what you do if you play Wheel of Fortune. If you're an old person, you play Wheel of Fortune. What do you do with Wheel of Fortune? You know, what letters do you guess? Yeah, you guess the ones that are most common in the English language, right? This is nothing, what I just described is nothing more than frequency analysis. If you know that certain plaintexts are more likely than others, then you can assume that the ciphertexts, when you see them often, are in fact encrypting the message that you expect to be sent most often. And that's leaked by the fact that this is still a deterministic mapping. If I send the same message twice, I see the same ciphertext twice. So we got to break that somehow. Here's how we do that in cypherblock chaining. There's some value that we call the IV, the initial value, sometimes referred to as the initialization vector, initial value, we'll call it. We have this thing called the IV. We send this as the first ciphertext block now, because we're going to need this to be able to decrypt. And we just repeat the process. This is cipherblock chaining. Well, let's talk about it. We have to change syntax in a moment, we will. Well, let's just talk about this thing. What do I need to do, like this IV? I have to send it. First of all, let's talk about decryption. How do you decrypt?
Backwards.
Yeah, you decrypt backwards, right? You start here, you go backwards to the block checker, you get that, you take this ciphertext value, you measure them together, you make that message. And so on, right? So you go all the way back. Okay, good. So you can decrypt. And of course, you need the IV to be able to decrypt, because when you go backwards to here, you know this, and I'll give you that back. Okay? So this is an example. You asked for an example of an encryption scheme in which the plaintext and ciphertext were at different lengths. Actually, I think what you said was different sets. These are still the same sets, right? This is still a string from strings of multiples of length n. But it's longer now. We have what's called ciphertext stretch, or ciphertext expansion here. The ciphertext is longer than the plaintext by exactly n bits. Well, we're hoping that in paying the cost for having to transmit that extra n bits, we get something useful out of it. Would it be useful if I just fix the IV to the all zero string for all time?
No.
No. Because we again have deterministic math. If you repeat the same message, you get the same ciphertext. So that's not going to work. In fact, it wouldn't work no matter what value I fixed there. If I had a random value here, we fixed it. Well, first of all, I see what this is. I'm looking on the wire, so I know what the IV is. Moreover, it doesn't change anything, right? Any fixed value here is going to be bad. So what are we going to want to do with this IV? Well, not just random, because I just gave an example of randomizing it that didn't work.
Change it.
When?
Every method. Entire message.
Every time you encrypt, you change the ID. Every time you encrypt, you change the ID. So let's go with this idea of having a per message random IV. This actually works, and this you can in fact prove is secure once we establish the notion for what it means for encryption scheme to be secure. But let's go with kind of a strawman notion of security. Let's say that what we want is for an adversary to be unable to distinguish between the ciphertext that it sees and truly random bit strings of the same length. Yeah? So imagine this game, I'm giving you an oracle, and either you get CBC mode, and you can ask this oracle messages of your choosing, and in fact, of almost any length, so long as they are multiples of n bits long. You either get this thing as an oracle, or you get an oracle that when you ask it a message of a correct length, it outputs a random bit string of the appropriate length, which in this case is the length of the message plus n bits. Yeah? That's your game. So, in fact, CBC mode does meet this security notion, and we'll actually formalize it. Why? Let's say that this is a per message random value. So this is random, so this is random. We XOR that then with whatever message block is here. We know that anything XOR with random is random, so this is random. And it's the first time this has been called, so this is random. We're assuming this is a good PRP. Yeah? So this is random. So this is random, which then gets XOR with this thing, which means this is random, and almost certainly not the same value you wanted here before. So this is random. Yeah? And so on. So the output blocks from here are in fact computationally indistinguishable from just random bit strings. Cool. In fact, that's referred to as CBC mode with a random IV. When you hear somebody say with a random IV, be clear in your head that what they mean is a per message. Well, so we have to change syntax, right? Because this is no longer that. This thing now takes in more inputs than in particular, it takes in this new thing, which is neither message nor key. So we're going to adjust the syntax here. We're going to add in an extra set. Now encryption is going to take a key and an ID from this set script B. Likewise, decryption is going to take in a key and an ID. That's it. Looks a lot like a gamma. There you go. That's better. Where this is now referred to as the ID space. Okay. So let's talk about CBC mode. What are the upsides of CBC mode?
More deterministic problems.
Not deterministic, we got rid of that. That's good. In fact, as I said, we'll be able to prove that at least so long as you have messages that live in the set, this thing is in fact going to give you ciphertext that are indistinguishable from random bits. In fact, that's as good as you can do. That is the gold standard security notion for encryption schemes. So there's that. Has that going for it? How about operationally? Can we parallelize in either direction?
No.
You can. In one direction.
Going backwards.
Yeah, you can parallelize decryption. You can't. It is fundamentally serial for encryption because you have to wait. You can't produce the next ciphertext block until you produce the one before it, right? So it is fundamentally serial in the encryption direction, but decryption you can do in parallel. Because what do? You take this and this to create that, but I can also take this and this at the same time to make that, and so on. So I can, in fact, decrypt in parallel. So that's nice. What are some downsides to CBC mode?
You know what the IV is?
That actually doesn't make any difference. No. In fact, the attack model that we're going to specify is that, well, one of the attack models we're going to specify, the adversary will actually get to pick the ID. So the fact that you know it doesn't actually help.
Keeping track.
You have to be very careful, actually, with CBC mode in particular, but this is one loss. But yeah, so, okay, sure, you can see the ID. That's not actually a drawback if you do things properly. In particular, if you do CVC mode with a per message random ID, it's not a problem. What are some things not to like?
You have to generate a random string every time.
You do, right. So you have to harvest randomness. And not just one time for the key, but now you need every message. So if you're encrypting lots of, if you're doing, you know, one or two very long messages, that's not too bad. You can amortize that cost. If you're encrypting lots of short messages, it can be expensive. You have to make system calls to get randomness, and those can block. You know, most good random number sources will block if they have these built-in tests that will tell them, you know, it's likely that what I'm about to output doesn't have much entropy in it, so I'm going to block until I get more, until I'm happy with it. So you can have blocking issues. So yeah, having to harvest this extra random is going to be a problem operationally. What else?
Do you have to exchange the IV with whoever you're trying to communicate with?
Well, you said that. So this is actually the ciphertext.
Oh, because that's the first block, yeah.
We can only encrypt messages that are multiples of the block length long. And sure, that gives you already a lot of flexibility, but how often is it the case that you have messages that are exactly multiples of, say, 128 bits long? If you really want, really what we want to be able to do is deliver to somebody a primitive, a library call that says, shove in your file. Yeah, I don't care how long it is, just stick it in here, I'll encrypt it for you. And it'll be fine, you'll be secure, you're safe doing that. So we do have this restriction that we can only encrypt messages that are multiple minutes long. And we're going to want to actually move from a plain text space that is that to a plain text space that is 01 star messages of any. And we can't do that here. Yeah? If we build in additionally a padding scheme, then we can handle it. But that's a separate thing you have to implement now. You have to implement separately a padding scheme, right? So, and as I said, that can be very hard to do. And in fact, if you pad this thing incorrectly, then in settings in which, so let me sort of tease it for you. If you do a bad job of padding this, and you're imagining an attacker on the wire that sees the ciphertext and blocks it, and changes some bits of the ciphertext, and then sends that to the receiver, in not too many attempts, you actually can start to recover plain text bits based on how the receiver responds. In particular, if the receiver doesn't close the connection when it receives a ciphertext that doesn't, so Amish, back up. What would you do when you decrypted if you had some kind of padding at the end? You decrypt, and how would you check that the thing you decrypted is almost certainly the thing that was actually sent by the honest sender?
Check the padding,
right? Because if this thing is a good SPRP, then if I change bits here, it should change effectively every bit here, right? Because if I change one bit, it's a random permutation in that direction, but I get a random value here. So if I change bits here, then I'll randomize this entire thing. So if my padding is, if I have some deterministic padding scheme at the end, say like all zeros, which is a valid one, all zeros at the end, I just check and see whether the last how many bits, the last 32 bits or 40 bits, are in fact all zeros. If they're not, I raise some error flag. Yeah. If I don't close the connection, but just send a message back that says padding error, which, by the way, is useful. It's useful for developers to know why things were failing. And SSL, which then became TLS 1.0 and TLS 1.1, all the way to until TLS 1.2, actually allowed this for operational reasons. It allowed you to return a message back that said padding was an error, but did not mandate that you close the connection. And by looking at these padding errors, what you learn is, I mauled this ciphertext block in a particular way, and the padding wasn't right. And if I know something about the padding, This thing went back through. I know what this value was because I saw it. I get some value here, and what I learned is the last 64 bits were not the correct padding, which actually tells me something about the last 64 bits of the message that should have been here if I had sent the correct thing back. And you can bootstrap this. It becomes worse when you start doing things like not only doing padding, but also putting on the end some kind of authentication tag. Because now you have multiple error messages. The padding was bad, or the authentication tag was bad, which tells me now whether or not I got the padding right in the process of calling this thing. So there's a whole rich thing. We'll actually talk about these things in detail. But handling messages of arbitrary length with CPC mode is hard. It's very brittle in that respect. Okay. So that's CPC mode. We have our new perspective syntax from crypto schemes. And by the way, you could likewise describe ECB mode with the syntax. How?
Zeros in the IV space.
Well, yeah, you could do that. You could just say the IV set consists of a single string, which is the all zero string. That would work. Or you could just declare the IV space is empty. So there's effectively no IV. So you can still handle the thing we just had. Okay, well, I'll leave that picture up there. And let me show you one more. So this one looks a lot like ECB mode. You do everything in parallel, as before. But we're going to change what goes into the block cipher. So in particular, is it time to go?
Yeah.
When we stop. So let me draw the picture at least, and then we'll go. And everything we've seen so far, the plain text goes in and gets processed. We're not going to do that here. Here what we're going to do is actually XOR in the plain text once on the outputs. We should still get the same effect, which is that if what's coming out of here is random, then if I XOR, I get something random, right? Mm-hmm. So how do we ensure that we get random things out of here? We know if we ask the permutation distinct values, it gives us fresh values, right? And in particular, this is a like a random permutation, and if we ask it distinct values, then we get randomly distinct values out. So what we're going to do is, in fact, have a counter. This is called a counter mode. It works like this. We're still going to have an ID. We'll have an ID. So we're going to basically break this into the two ways to count on. I'm pretty sure the one that is best. So we're going to break this ended block into an ID and a block counter. So this is going to be some number of bits. It's called B bits. Yeah. So we're going to take 10 bits, we're going to break it into two pieces. B will be a fixed value. And each block will start with the IV and then increment. So I'm going to introduce a new notation here for you. This angle bracket notation, B below, is the encoding of this integer as a B bit string.
Yeah.
Yeah? So the canonical way would be, of course, this is just the all zeros. Here, we'll have the encoding of the integer 1. As a B-bit string. I don't care what encoding it is, it just has to be some, you know, encoding scheme that you fix. And you do this all the way out to the end. There are L blocks of message. This is not like that's counter. Actually matter so long as you have distinct values going in. This is counter mode. It is way better than CPC mode. But we're going to have to wait to next time to see why. It has better security properties. It's, for one thing, parallelizable in both directions. It also natively admits strings of any length. See why. message that is not a multiple of elements of any sort. Now, I was taking care of the fact that I XOR the block.
Yeah.
If this last block is short, if this is, say, only 1 bit long, well, I just take 1 bit of this and XOR the output. Yeah? So it natively emits already strings of anything without any kind of hack. All right, so next time we will have a nice long day. We'll actually start to analyze these things. I still haven't finished the whole story about CBC mode. Handling this ID is critical. Come on Tuesday. We'll discuss these things. We'll actually do the proof that element.